The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I think there's a lot of organisational projection, I think, in this work, and that's about fear. And I think, to be sort of, forgive me for being a bit Freudian about it, but I think organisations almost act as a bit of a sort of superego, you know, and they sort of become this sort of critical parent who, you know, will be very harsh and punishing if you actually get things wrong, you know, and I think that filters down through the organisation. So individual social workers actually really feel this fear when they work in this field.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones.
So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
So today we're delighted to welcome along Diane Wills. Diane is a former probation officer, a social worker and a psychotherapist, and she now works independently in a variety of roles offering therapy, consultation, professional supervision, quality assurance and training for individuals and organisations. She's a trustee for Circles Southwest, and she also offers support to other practitioners working in the area of risk assessment and management. And Diane spent her career specialising in working with men who've committed serious sexual offences and is an author in this field. Away from work, she has four children and runs a lot. So pleased to have you on today, Diane. Welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
That's true,
isn't
it? You run a lot, do you? What does running a lot mean?
I think it's my way of emotionally regulating. I think it's probably healthier than lithium and gets me into the outdoors, gets me out of the house. So I run probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 times a week, and it's probably the only thing I've found that kind of really works.
Yeah.
So while the body can still do it, I'll carry on.
Exactly, yes. Well, that sounds great. So you gave a true psychotherapist's answer when I was wondering whether you ran 500 metres or 10 miles along Cornish roads.
Somewhere in between, usually.
Thank you. So can we begin by you perhaps telling us a bit about yourself and how you've come to get to doing the kind of activities that you do, which also has included writing a practical guide to working with sex offenders?
Yeah, well, we wrote the book. Well, it was one of those things that seemed like a really good idea at the time until we kind of, you know, had to sort of sit down and do it. And I co-wrote the book with my husband, and that was a learning experience in and of itself. So, yeah, but the reason that we kind of came to write it is because I do a lot of sort of risk assessment, consultation, quality assurance work for local authorities, and realised that social workers can feel really de-skilled in this particular area of work. And actually, they are highly skilled, highly well-trained individuals. They've got loads of assessment skills that are really easily transferable. So I suppose I wanted to make working in this field more comfortable, more accessible, perhaps. Also wanted to sort of debunk some tropes, well-used tropes that people kind of tend to hold on to, myths, and maybe kind of humanise the perpetrators a little bit, so that the perpetrators become just like you and I, although obviously they've done dreadful things, but actually as human beings they are just like the rest of us. And I think that's probably a helpful starting point for professionals to kind of hold on to. But yeah, Andy, my husband, is definitely the, I describe him as the brains behind the outfit. He's the real academic in the family, but I suppose I'm the practitioner. I'm the person on the ground that does a lot of the kind of day-to-day operational work. And you know, we would obviously talk about things between us quite a lot. We don't always talk about work. We usually talk about the kids, actually, but sometimes we talk about work. And I suppose we realised we had something that we could offer. So yeah, that's how the book came about.
Thank you. So
yes.
Describe yourself as a social worker, but also you've got a probation background, haven't you, as well?
That's right. Yes. Yeah, so I've got a real mixture of both. I actually, my substantive initial qualification was as a probation officer. And so I sort of worked in public protection, worked in the group work, sex offender group work as it was at the time. So I was a national trainer. I had a secondment to the Home Office. So I really, really loved that. But we moved to Scotland in 2008, I think. And Scotland obviously have a devolved administration and don't have a probation service. So I sort of became a social worker by default, really. But in doing that, I gained loads of skills. So I did work that I hadn't done before. So I worked in kind of children and families. I worked with disabled children. I started my kind of practice educator role there, where I was sort of supervising other people coming through the social work training. So it was actually what started as, I suppose, something that felt a little bit frustrating actually turned into a real opportunity for me. But I'd always had social work in my background. So prior to being qualified in anything, I'd worked as a, it would be called a call taker now, I suppose, in my local emergency duty team, social services. So although I wasn't a social worker then, that was an incredible learning opportunity. So it helped me learn loads about legislation. So I understood all this kind of social work legislation. I started to understand thresholds. I understood what constituted an emergency in terms of all the various disciplines of social work. I'd also had a little bit of time as a complaints investigator in adult social care. So I've always sort of been betwixt and between social work and probation, really.
Well, I find that very interesting, Diane, because I originally trained as a social worker. I don't think I had anywhere near the level of skill or experience that you've got. And the idea of, you know, social workers working with people who've committed sexual offences, I think I'd have found terrifying. And I felt a lot of my colleagues would have been very similar. Why do you think that might be?
I think social workers have a really hard time. So I think they're wrong. You know, they're professional scapegoats, aren't they? They're wrong if they take action. They're wrong if they don't take action. And I think there's a terrible sort of disabling fear around that. I suppose like every discipline. So I sort of have some involvement in social work training, and every specialism will say that social workers don't get enough training in, you know, whatever their specialism is. So they don't get enough training in forensic work, in risk assessment, in, perhaps substance use, or, you know, so they get a sort of generic training. And I guess unless people are placed in particular areas where they kind of need to learn about this particular topic, or they have a particular interest in it, maybe they're likely to not feel skilled up enough to be able to sort of do it with the confidence that they would want to. I think there's a lot of organisational projection, I think, in this work, and that's about fear. And I think to be sort of, forgive me for being a bit Freudian about it, but I think organisations almost act as a bit of a sort of superego, you know, and they sort of become this sort of critical parent who, you know, will be very harsh and punishing if you actually get things wrong, you know, and I think that filters down through the organisation. So individual social workers actually really feel this fear when they work in this field. And that's not surprising at all. There's a, as I said before, there's a lot of holding on to sort of tropes and myths. So people kind of get little bits of information that they might have heard somewhere along the line, or someone might have said somewhere along the line, and they kind of hold on to that a little bit. And again, that's, I think that's a sort of fear-based response. That's about perhaps not really allowing for the sort of possibility of change, or the possibility that actually things may not be quite as risky as they perhaps look. People's own anxieties, you know, play a big part in it as well. You know, people's own experiences play a big part in it. You know, I think there's a mixture of organisational response, but also individual response. And it's really easy, isn't it? It's really easy to other these people that do these dreadful things. It's a really easy response, and it's a comfortable response to pretend that these people that we work with are really different to you and I, or to anybody else we might meet. And I think by that very kind of othering, that prevents people from really allowing themselves to understand the person that they're working with.
You mentioned, Diane, the role of the organisation in terms of this fear that the organisation is going to be very punitive. I wondered if there's a wider involvement of society in this regard as well, because I was looking at a post on LinkedIn where somebody was drawing attention to it. I think the plot was probably EastEnders, and pointing out how social workers are depicted. And, you know, it does seem as though social workers in the media are generally depicted as being either very heavy-handed and removing children willy-nilly, or otherwise being kind of like totally careless and not bothering and not looking after the children. We don't really see images of social workers doing the job well within the media, do we? You know, whether that be in films, books, whatever.
Absolutely, I totally agree with you. I think there's a lot to be said about the portrayal of social workers and how unhelpful that generally is. And as you say, they're either kind of child snatchers, or they're pretty ineffective do-gooders, you know. And I think that's a really unhelpful portrayal. I think there's a current campaign at the moment, Respect for Social Work, which is working really hard actually to try and influence some of these media portrayals, whether they be on soap operas or, you know, any other kind of media platform, to sort of try and debunk some of this. Because, you know, we don't get the stories where things have gone really well. We only get the stories when things have gone really, really badly, of course. So, you know, I really think they have a dreadfully hard time, actually, probably more so than most other professions in areas of work where they're working with kind of risk.
And do you think social workers reflect very much upon the kind of fear and anxieties that you've just been describing?
I think fear is probably not as openly discussed as might be helpful. And I think what happens when we kind of, I suppose all of us, when we form our sort of professional identities, we kind of, you know, in that process, we form our professional defences as well against our own very natural kind of emotional responses to the work that we do. And actually, in my view, it's probably more helpful to acknowledge those emotional responses and sort of lean into them, as opposed to trying to pretend that they're not there, or trying to manage it in a different way. And I think it's those, I think it's not attending to those emotional responses that, that probably contributes to the burnout that we tend to see in the social work profession. And, you know, this sort of, you know, denial of these sort of very, very normal emotional responses, actually, you know, to the work, and wondering if people, wondering if we've got things right or got things wrong. You know, it's really normal to be kind of quite fearful about that. You know, this fear of getting it wrong and someone becoming harmed is a, you know, is a very healthy, normal fear that that one would have. There's also, you know, lots of other fears associated with that, aren't there? There's fears of us being harmed as well, and that might be kind of directly harmed by the people that we work with or the families that we work with, but it also might be organisational harm that might occur if we do get something wrong. And, you know, again, to be a little bit Freudian about it, you know, we've all obviously got our own unconscious fears that we're all kind of battling with day in, day out as well, you know. So I think fear is around a lot more than is openly spoken about.
Just thinking as you're talking, Diane, because you both have a background in social work, but both chosen to move on from that. And I think one of the conversations that David and I had at the start of doing this podcast was about how it's probably not healthy to work in prisons for your entire working career. There's probably a time limit for how long it's possible to do that and remain, protect your own well-being. And I wondered if there's a similar shelf life for being a social worker. You know, is it a job that where the demands are so high that actually it's probably better to develop other skills and use your social work experience to contribute to enhancing the profession in other ways rather than performing the role as, you know, a key role of being a social worker?
I think that's really dependent on the individual and probably how well they know themselves and how well they attend to looking after themselves, because I think that about myself, really, about the work that I do. I've, you know, I've been involved in working with serious sexual offenders for I don't know, like 20 years or something. And it was through the first COVID lockdown when I couldn't go to work in prisons because we weren't allowed to, and I kind of had this realization, I suppose, of how trauma based my life is, really, and how unhealthy that could really be. And I remember having a discussion about it with my supervisor at the time, who was experiencing a sort of similar epiphany. Yeah, and I think it's really easy to not step outside of that sometimes and see what's going on. But I think it's healthy to do other things anyway. So, you know, I would always do a variety of work in my life, because that kind of keeps me healthy and interested and all of those things. So I think it is healthy to do other things. I think you can be a social worker for a long time, but I think it probably takes quite a lot of active work on yourself to maintain those levels of self-awareness and resilience and coping in a really healthy way. There was some research, actually, I read quite recently. I think it was Zoe Ash and Ben Gray, and they did some research about social workers and their own trauma experiences impacting on their work with clients. And I think that's definitely an area that probably requires a bit of exploration, and that resonates very much with my experience of working with social workers.
Thanks, Diane. What are your thoughts, David?
Well, yeah, I was just thinking back, really, because I suppose I worked as a social worker for about 10 years, and reflecting on it now, I don't think I had any particularly traumatic experiences, but I do have people I feel guilty about. I have young people I work with who I feel I didn't do enough with, or somehow didn't help get onto the right path. And what I remember is this was always something carried by myself. It wasn't anything I talked about with others. There wasn't a forum for talking about those things, even though we had supervision. Supervision was a fairly practical based activity. So I was wondering if that's still the case, Diane, or if there's a more kind of sensitive kind of supervision within the social work and probation fields now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably varies. So I'm sure in some places, I wouldn't want to say it doesn't exist, because, you know, I'll get complaints that it does in one particular area or something. But as far as I'm aware, it's not universally accessible. And clinical supervision is so helpful. And I remember having it as a sort of, as a probation officer in my early career, and we had a clinical supervisor who used to come along and talk to us about not only the clients that we were working with, but also about how we were functioning as a team and what our relationships were like and the dynamics between that. And it was such an incredibly helpful, cathartic process. So it's a real shame that isn't universally present anymore for people. And of course, we all know, you know, the cuts to services, that I'm sure those kinds of services are seen as very much luxuries rather than essentials. And, you know, line management supervision, of course, has a place. It's about accountability. And of course, that must continue, but it's a really different process, as you say, David, to sort of clinical supervision. So, yeah, I think it would be very useful to have that, if at all possible.
I'm just sticking with that kind of like the idea about fear and how people make sense of things. I was thinking about the specialist assessments where expert witnesses are called in to, often psychologists, for instance, to family courts. And do you think those specialist assessments are always necessary? Because sometimes I've been instructed in cases where I've looked at the files and I've just thought, oh God, all of the evidence is pointing in one direction. You know, is there really a need for yet another person to get involved with the family and do an assessment? Do you think sometimes that those assessments arise because of fear of being held responsible?
Absolutely. I definitely don't think they're always necessary at all. And when I'm approached by a local authority, when I've kind of done a bit of reading and thought, actually, the team can probably manage this themselves with a little bit of consultancy, that's something that I always offer. And, you know, from a very practical and ethical point of view, it's a cheaper option. It's a lower cost option for them than having a kind of full assessment. So I always offer that. And it, as you say, it means that the clients don't have another person that they have to kind of tell their life history to, and all of those things. But there is something about the accountability that's held for the risk, and I think that is sometimes projected by organisations onto the external assessor, and I think I think sometimes organisations don't necessarily want to have all of that accountability, so they would rather have an external expert coming along and saying, you know, what they think about things. And it's something tangible, isn't it? A report is something tangible that, you know, can be held in a file and can be looked at and can be drawn on, and, you know, recommendations can be kind of pointed to and, you know, leveraged, I suppose. So I understand that it's a tangible piece of evidence, I suppose, that organisations tend to like. But, you know, the very thing about assessments is they're really only valid for, you know, the time in which you're assessing. So, you know, the nature of people is that they're so sort of dynamic that assessments are actually sort of quite limited, really. And I've certainly had experiences where I've written a sort of assessment and then I've had to write addendum after addendum after addendum because something has changed in someone's circumstances. And actually, I'm absolutely sure the team could manage that with a little bit of consultancy, probably. But also, you know, none of us like getting savaged in the family court, you know, and I've certainly had my fair share of that. So in some, you know, I sort of understand the desire to sort of give that experience to someone else as well.
Yeah, I suppose just I wouldn't want to put anybody off doing expert witness for family courts because I know it's really, really difficult to get experts in. There aren't enough experts available, are there? And I suppose my experience of family court work generally is that there's much more a sense of people looking for what is the best interest of the family, unlike criminal proceedings, for instance. So family court work can be quite rewarding, but as you say, it's a lot of responsibility if you're thinking about what's going to be best for that child and its long-term outcomes. In complex families, how can we manage the competing needs of children and their parents? Because often the parents come with their own huge histories of trauma, don't they?
Absolutely, and I think that's really difficult. And I think that's really difficult for organisations to manage because, well, you know, because of resources as much as anything else. But, you know, my experience of parents is that, you know, they need a bit of, you know, nurturing too, just as we all do. And often, you know, their children are at the attention of social services because of the parents' own experiences in their own childhood and their own kind of experiences of trauma, and their own difficulties with being parented. So my approach is to always try and offer something helpful and supportive, even if it's just signposting, for all of the family who, you know, who I'm sort of involved with, because, you know, we know that's needed. If you're kind of working in silos, of course that never works.
Yeah, I often think it's very impressive how social workers working with families that see an impact on a child but are also able to hold in mind these awful histories of the parents. And I think, you know, my experience often is that the assessment isn't so much about whether the immediate risk to the child can be managed, it's much more about having some empathy for the parents and wanting to find a way to put their life on a different course. So it's not going to help the immediate circumstances, but whether it might help those parents in the future.
Absolutely.
You do see an awful lot of compassion extended for, in, you know, really, really difficult circumstances.
Yeah, definitely. And sometimes it's the case that a child does, you know, have to be removed out of a family for their safety, but that doesn't also mean that something can happen at the same time for the parents to try and help things become a bit safer, you know. So absolutely, I agree.
And I think that's what we don't tend to see in the media. You don't see that huge amounts of compassion being exhibited despite, you know, in the face of really quite challenging information to make sense of. And it'd be nicer to see more of that, I think, in the media rather than this kind of like very binary perspectives on social workers.
Yes, absolutely.
Periodically, we see high profile cases where children have been harmed or even killed, followed by a serious incident review inquiry. How can professionals be confident they're making defensible decisions, do you think?
Yeah, I think defensible decisions are about having access, firstly, to all the relevant information, but also crucially, knowing what you don't have, what information isn't there, and how that would impact on any assessment that you make, what kind of difference that would make if you had that kind of information. So I think that's a real starting point, and that, you know, also means talking to different agencies and people, different agencies who are perhaps involved with the family. I think there's also something about using some kind of coherent structure to an assessment, either an accredited risk assessment tool that people might be trained in, but even if it is just some kind of framework which makes sense, and that people are clearly understanding and stating what their methodology is for doing those kinds of assessments, and for themselves understanding about how they tend to approach those assessments and what the limitations of that is, and if there are limitations, how can those limitations be managed? And that might be about, you know, it might be as simple as kind of quality assurance type work, or it might be having another mind to think with, or having someone that's got some other training that can assist with it, approaching things from a slightly different angle. I suppose where I have a lot of privilege, really, because I've worked across disciplines. I think I tend to approach work with quite a broad knowledge base, and I think a lot of professionals are reliant on perhaps one approach or one kind of methodology that their organisation might have really bought into and that they tend to use. Thinking about bias as well in your work, how it's manifesting, and what you're noticing about that, and what that might indicate to you, either about yourself or about the person that you're assessing, or about the dynamic between you, and how that's coming across. Really thinking about language, so noticing perhaps when your language is perhaps becoming a little bit, I don't know, I see this quite often, but a little bit punitive, you know, and actually that's about your response to what's happening. I suppose the biggest one for me, and when I'm quality assuring, that the thing that I'm working with people most often on is analysis. There's got to be some kind of really quite complex thinking about why people are behaving in the way that they are. There has to be some sort of hypothesizing about that. And that's a bit that I find people feel really worried about doing. They seem to be really worried about saying, this is why I think this has happened. But for me, that's the absolute key of writing a really good report and making really defensible decisions about what you think should happen. Of course, you know, no decision is taken in isolation, but your decision might be a key influencer in what happens and what recommendations that you might make about that. And also thinking about that, you know, how it's not enough to say, whatever it might be, this person, you know, might be at high risk of harming a child. So what can happen? How can someone be helped to change? How can someone be supported to be a safer adult? Not necessarily in that particular family, but generally for their future. What resources are out there to help someone to be able to change? And I would say always sort of stating the limitations of assessments. We're not, you know, we haven't, you know, we can't predict the future. We can only make assessments based on all the information that we have at the time and with the experience and the knowledge that we have at the time, and things change and we learn more. So there are always massive, massive limitations to any kind of decisions that we make. But I think if people do all of those things, then that's about as defensible as we can get, I think.
I think it's really interesting to hear you honing on the idea that there needs to be a kind of a function to the behaviour and the circumstances identified, because without that really you run the risk, don't you, of it being a very biased assessment, either because you like the person or you dislike the person. If it doesn't hang together with some kind of coherence about why things are happening. But I wondered, as you were talking, within the justice sector generally, there's been a move towards trying to think a bit more about protective factors and using assessments that focus on those. Is that something that you also see in the work that you do?
Yeah, I think there are, you know, and people tend to use assessment tools to kind of look at protective factors as well. And I do see that coming through. But I think in my experience that area could be strengthened, because I think it's about, so if you're identifying protective factors, how can these be enhanced? How can someone be really, really supported to make those? Usually it's really transformational change that someone needs to go through to live as a safe adult. So that, you know, that takes resources, it takes courage, it takes commitment. So how someone can really be supported to be different, it's not something that can happen overnight. It's something that takes time and energy. And yeah, so I think it's great that protective factors are identified much more now, but I think that could still be developed.
Thank you, Diane. I was mulling over something that you said earlier, I hope I've remembered it more or less correctly, but I think you were referring to the importance of somebody's self-awareness, their self-knowledge, so a probation officer or a social worker's awareness of themselves as being terribly important in relation to the kind of work that they could do. So I wonder if you could expand a bit upon that, and also tell us about the work that you do supporting social workers and probation officers in their professional and personal development. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I completely. So as in my psychotherapy training, I quite rightly had to have my own personal therapy. So I've had personal therapy for several years now. And that's been such a key factor in my knowing myself and developing self-awareness. And of course we all do anyway, as kind of life moves on. But doing that with someone else who's trained to do that, I think, is such a facilitative process. And it doesn't happen in every organisation. So it happens with therapists, but it doesn't necessarily happen with social workers. It doesn't happen with probation officers. It doesn't necessarily happen with forensic psychologists. And all of these people are kind of doing such difficult work day in, day out. And when something is offered, it sometimes feels a little bit tokenistic. So it can sometimes just be part of a general kind of HR employment assistance program or something of the like. And of course, you know, the therapists who work in those programs are highly trained, highly qualified therapists, but you may not speak to the same therapist on consecutive sessions, you know, so there's a little opportunity to build a real kind of therapeutic relationship that you might have with somebody. So And in my view, and it is just my view, but when, you know, the fact that we're in this work is not a coincidence. So I think thinking about what draws us to this work in the first place is a really helpful start of the process. And thinking about what Naomi was saying earlier about people who work in prisons and how there's a bit of a shelf life to it. You know, I'm always really taken with the concept of prison as a brick mother. I think that was Henri Ray who kind of first coined that phrase. And that really strikes me, that it's as true for the staff in prisons as it is for the residents in prison. And I think just some exploration about what that means for people would be really helpful. You know, and just getting in touch with some of these kind of core emotions and, you know, what goes on for you at quite a core level, and the triggers. You know, I've lost count of how many times I've been really unexpectedly kind of triggered, you know, when I've been working with somebody. And it still happens now. Happened a few months ago that someone said something and it kind of completely triggered me into a sort of time in my adolescence when I might, you know, when I had a sort of similar experience. And, you know, and I think having the therapy just helps us to understand, firstly, kind of what's happening in the moment and be able to kind of manage that professionally and appropriately, but also helps us to kind of manage and think really carefully about our responses to the people that we're working with. So, you know, I work with people sometimes and I feel like, well, if I'm being really honest, sometimes I feel like I want to kick them, you know. And, you know, that's about me, and, you know, that's about my response to being triggered by something they are doing or saying, or, you know, and it's rarely about the actual kind of offence that they've committed. It's usually other stuff. But, you know, I kind of have to go away and really think about that, think about what is blocking me from being from responding compassionately to this person, you know. And once I've kind of worked it out, once I've kind of really sat and thought about it, and I do really sit and think about it really carefully, I can usually then come back, and I can usually then, I don't think there's been anybody yet that I haven't been able to find some compassion for, you know. But I have to do my own processing to be able to get there. And I think it's so important. And I just think people would be, well, they'd probably be better practitioners, but they'd feel better in themselves, and they'd feel healthier, and, you know, be able to feel like they were working with their strengths rather than sort of, you know, being feeling under constant pressure all the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was taken by your use of the phrase the brick mother, which I hadn't heard before, actually. So I'll be looking into it later on, I think. But it always struck me, working in prisons, that there was something containing about that, and I suppose that's what you're referring to. There is something actually containing about the structures around the prison, which kept, you know, everyone inside mostly safe, I think. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm also thinking about what you're saying about tokenistic gestures to, because I go to a number of places where I know people had to work terribly hard during the pandemic and during lockdown, because some people had to work all the way through it, others weren't allowed to go into work and had to work from a distance, which set up all kinds of tensions, I think, and all kinds of resolutions. One of the resolutions I frequently come across when I go around visiting places in the country is of an online reflective practice group, and I can see how these came into being, but I'm terrified that they may gain some ongoing place in practice when I think they're at best a token, you know, because you're meeting with could be 10 or 12 different people each time. Anyway, I don't know, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree. I think there is a, you know, there's a place for all of these resources. I was just reading yesterday about text therapy and email therapy, and I thought, oh, that's really interesting, you know. And I think there's a place for all of these things, and we, you know, we all should be able to access things in the way that is most comfortable for us. Of course, we don't want to sort of, you know, don't want to put any barriers up to people accessing services. But actually, when people are working for organisations who expect them on a daily basis to manage high levels of trauma day in, day out, manage high levels of risk, actually, I think there's a real responsibility there to do it properly, actually.
Hmm.
I have to say, I've really changed my mind about online support over the last couple of years. So I was part of a reflective practice group for about 18 months of the pandemic period. And actually, it felt very warm and very connected. But I think we did all know each other prior to that happening. So that probably helped in some way. But for me, at times, that was a real lifeline. So I think when people are very at great distances, you know, prior to the pandemic, we would all have to travel down to London, and
yes.
So it would be a whole
yes.
day. And so actually, there would always be somebody who couldn't make it because of the time commitment. But actually, I think because we did know each other, there was a degree of comfort. And I have also heard people talking about therapy, and for people with a lot of trauma, I think actually to be able to do the therapy and be in the safety of your own home and not have to navigate getting home after a painful therapy session can also at times be really useful for people. But I think there is something about in-person, a live interaction offers a lot more potential, doesn't it, than looking at a little screen on your computer.
But I think you're talking about...
It offers a more intense experience, perhaps, also. Sorry, David.
Yeah, go on.
And as you say, Naomi, I think there's a real space for, you know, I've joined quite a lot of online forums in one way or another since the pandemic. And as you say, for in terms of distance, I think it's really helpful. And I've certainly worked with clients who, for their own trauma experiences, can't sit in a room with me for 50 minutes, you know, and we have to kind of build up to that, you know. So I think that's right. But there's something about being in a room with another person or other people that it's a different experience. It's a different experience that makes things go live in a way that online sessions perhaps don't quite so much.
And I think the kind of setting that you're talking about, Naomi, is a small group of people who have known each other and been in the group consistently over a good length of time. So I've just spoken to you, Naomi, but you don't need to answer.
Sorry, I left the door locked so my son couldn't get in the house. No, I just realised that I heard a hammering at the door. Sorry, David. Did you ask me?
No, I was just saying that the group you were in was a small group with a consistent membership who you knew pretty well. And I think if one has kind of standards, you know, according to which the group is set up and continues, then that's a different matter, really. So... Just to move on a bit, what is it about the system, do you think, that hinders social workers and probation officers from using their skills, more effectively. I remember at the beginning of our conversation you were saying how they had this kind of large, you know, large number of skills and experience. So what factors within the system hinder their use?
I think I think we've already spoken a bit about fear, so I think that's one of the issues. I think there's just generally a bit less autonomy for professionals than perhaps there once was. That struck me very much last time I did any kind of agency work. Of just how much less able practitioners were to work in a way that suited them, I suppose, and felt most comfortable for them, rather than a very prescribed way of doing things. I think I don't know, and I think there's something about critical thinking that is not necessarily actually encouraged. And I know that's not necessarily a popular thing to say, but I think sometimes what happens is organisations sort of buy into particular models and methodologies and ways of doing things, really. And in my view, they should always be a help, you know, they should always be an aid to thinking things through. But I think sometimes in the way in which things are implemented, they sort of become a bit of a hindrance rather than a help. And that's for all sorts of reasons, I think. So I think people aren't necessarily encouraged to really think critically about the situation that they're faced with. And I think that's a shame, because that's what they get trained to do. You know, that's what practitioners get trained to do. But I think there's something about organisations which almost kind of dilutes that process a little bit.
Yeah.
We've spoken a lot about fear, Diane, but I'm conscious of the fact we previously had on Professor Rob Canton, who has written quite extensively about disgust, and about disgust, and thinking about your work, I imagine that disgust is another emotion that probably comes up fairly frequently, and wondered whether that gets spoken about much.
Yeah, and I think it probably, again, isn't quite so much, and I'm quite open about that. And you know, when I first allocated a person to work with, and I read through their case files as you know, is the first thing that we do, I feel the normal and natural responses that everybody feels, you know, that the disgust and the outrage and, you know, the anger and all of those things about how someone could do something so dreadful, and you know, and it's just really normal, isn't it, to feel all of those things. So that, you know, there are sort of core emotional responses, and I think it's healthy to acknowledge that they are present, and that, you know, and I think the way people can be assisted with that is through kind of really good supervision and team support. And usually what happens for me is, once I kind of get in a room with a person and they're no longer a case file, but they're a human being in front of me, some of that stuff becomes much more easy to understand and to manage. But yeah, I think that's right. I think as professionals, we're perhaps... I don't know if expected is the right word, but there's something about professional defensiveness that allows us to perhaps try and think that we're not affected in the same way that anybody on the street would be affected by reading some of the things that we have to read, or knowing what we know, you know. But of course we are you know, we are all affected in that way. And actually, when we stop being affected in that way, that's perhaps when we really need to think about what we're doing.
Absolutely. I was wondering whether, I suppose there's an expectation that we don't act out our disgust, and I wonder whether talking about disgust might feel frightening, because it might feel like it takes us a step towards acting disgusted, when in fact, actually, if we were talking about our disgust, it would, you know, I think usually when people behave in a way that's because they're disgusted, it's because they're not able to have a conversation and be conscious of what's driving them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point. I think that's it. And, you know, as you say, talking about it and actually kind of, as I, you know, the phrase I use is sort of leaning into it a bit, just, you know, working with it, you know, and actually acknowledging that, you know, that it's there is much healthier than pretending that it isn't.
Absolutely. So, Diane, we're coming to the end of the interview, and you've specialised in working in an area that many people shy away from. Have you taken any other steps to protect your well-being beyond personal therapy and running and keeping fit?
Well, it's worked so far. I suppose. I think I just recognise that I probably do this work as a way of making sense of my own experiences and my own life and my own kind of dark side, if you like, my own kind of, you know, shadow, I suppose. And I think that's okay, because I think I know it's there. And I think I acknowledge it regularly. I think I've got a really balanced life. So in terms of work, just the sort of personality type I am, I tend to wear a slightly different hat on different days, so I do lots of different things, so that keeps me healthy. I think I've clearly got a really busy family life as well, so definitely that helps. I've got really, really, really great friends as well, so I really look after myself, I think, and I surround myself. I don't think I've got, you know, I've got no friends who are not just the most positive and supportive and wonderful human beings, so I think I've really kind of cultivated that support network. And I think the running, it's not so much the running, it's more like the being outdoors. So there is something about having a bit of perspective and knowing that there is something bigger than myself that grounds me, I think. So I think having that sense of perspective really helps.
Well, I did wonder whether geography and the outdoors played a part, thinking about you living in Cornwall and having lived in Scotland. And we've had Dominique Moran talk on the podcast before, talking about green space, and we recently had Joe Sabian on talking about blue space. So I did wonder whether, you know, being engaged with the outdoors and the all that inspires, whether that also plays a, you know, helps you with your well-being.
Yeah, massively. My favourite word is susurration, which is the breeze in the noise the trees make when the breeze is in their leaves, and that is my absolute thing. You know, that's where I go. So I'm a big one for the trees, definitely.
That's really lovely answer, Diane. Thank you. Thanks very much for today. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely.
Thanks a lot. Great to meet you.